Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today, we dig into why the Selma City Council wants to get rid of at-large voting and map out districts instead. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Monica Velez. The Frying Kern Canal delivers water to farms and communities on the east side of the valley, and excess groundwater pumping is causing it to sink in some areas. We found out one possible but expensive fix.
But first, let's turn to this week's news. Tulare Congressman Devin Nunes' campaign committee dismissed a lawsuit it brought against three locals who said Nunes shouldn't have called himself a farmer on last year's ballot. Nunes' campaign alleged the three had engaged in civil conspiracy against the congressman. The lawyer representing the residents reserved a date for a hearing in court, saying they were being targeted for exercising their rights to free speech and to petition the government. That's when the Nunes campaign dropped the lawsuit.
Big news out of the Bakersfield Police Department this week. Assistant Chief of Police Evan Demestahaz has been arrested on suspicion of felony domestic violence. Police have revealed few details about the investigation, though in a press conference yesterday morning, Police Chief Lyle Martin promised a thorough investigation.
We believe that we had probable cause to arrest Assistant Chief Demestahaz, and we're going to move forward as an organization.
Demestahaz surrendered himself to the Taft City Jail and has been placed on administrative leave.
Also in Bakersfield, a long-serving detective was laid to rest this week after reportedly succumbing to the fungal disease Valley Fever. Detective Kevin Hawk, who had served nearly 30 years on the force, left behind a wife and son. Kern County reported a near-record amount of Valley Fever cases in 2018 and is on track to diagnose even more cases this year.
And a recent report asks, how could Yosemite National Park benefit if the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir were drained and restored? Author Mark Buckley, an economist with the consulting firm Eco Northwest, says more visitors would bring in more revenue to the park and surrounding areas.
So we're talking about hundreds of thousands to a million or more annual visitors, with expenditures from the tens of millions to over $100 million a year.
However, the report does not estimate the cost of restoration or propose alternative locations for the reservoir.
And last week, we reported on the possibility that Hanford's Carnegie Museum would be shuttered if repairs and maintenance weren't addressed. We have an update. The museum will not lose its lease after all. The board president and city officials met yesterday to discuss the remaining repairs, and they're working together to keep the building in good condition.
Listen for more FM 89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Access to primary health care is a fundamental need, but that access may be more challenging in the years to come for most Californians. By 2030, researchers say the state could be down more than 10,000 primary care providers, including nurse practitioners and physician assistants. Inner cities and rural areas are already feeling the squeeze, and it's going to get worse. As part of the California Dream Collaboration, Elizabeth Aguilera of CalMatters reports.
Are you short of breath all the time, or just when you get up and move around?
Just sometimes, all the time.
Comes and goes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Dr. Dan Daly visits Wilma Chesbro in the hospital where she's in long-term care. The 88-year-old former operating room nurse used to work with Daly.
I've been working there for 34 years, and I'm a family practice physician.
Daly cares for thousands of patients at the Big Valley Health Center in a part of the state where so few people live that it is considered frontier land.
This valley is about as beautiful a place you can get.
From his car, he pointed out the landmarks.
You can see Mount Lassen over there in that direction, and Mount Shasta here. You can see two of the most beautiful mountains on the planet, and all this area, farming and water and lakes out here. And it used to be that this place would recruit itself.
Not anymore. Daly is 71 and has postponed his retirement over and over again, waiting for a new doctor to arrive. His situation is not unique. High medical school debt pushes future doctors towards specialties that pay more, and new primary care doctors tend to practice in bigger cities near medical centers or for large medical groups. It's a problem in the inner city too, though, not just agricultural meccas or bucolic settings with mountain views.
It's difficult to find anyone in this area, but specifically doctors, because there are the shortages everywhere.
Shannon Gehrig is CEO of Mountain Valley's Health Centers.
And then we have a problem because we're so remote and rural. So often providers will come on site to visit and they will say, oh, well, we didn't know that it was this rural.
An added challenge in rural counties is that doctors have to be able to do a lot. Dally mans the Big Valley Health Center in Bieber, does a 24-hour shift in the emergency room at the nearby hospital every week, and does patient rounds most mornings at the hospital.
You have to be able to fly by the seat of your pants at times. You have to think on the run, and you sometimes have to do things that are out of the ordinary.
He's done it all, from delivering babies to saving people out in the woods. Dally is a local celebrity of sorts up here. Friends and patients greet him everywhere he goes in the area. The market, the bar, restaurants.
What are you doing?
They wave when they pass him on the road. That's why it's been so hard for Dally to retire. Right now, he's got his eye on a young doctor couple.
A lady who is in her third year of OBGYN residency at UC Davis, and her husband is a family practice resident. Well, we're trying to recruit him back up here because that will be when I retire.
Sounds perfect, except for one very big snag. The local hospital closed its obstetric department a few years ago, and Dally has been pushing hard to reopen it. Women in these parts travel more than 100 miles to deliver. One recent morning, Dally and patient Wilma Chesbro reminisced about their friendship.
How many years did we work together?
Oh, God.
She's going to say too many, working with you.
We had fun, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
It's important to Dally to leave his patients in good hands.
They're part of my family, and basically that's what I do. I'm getting a little tearful, but, you know, because I've had so many people praise me and stuff, I mean, I don't need all the gratification and all that stuff, but I'm so honored by the fact that they think that I'm a good doctor.
Good doctors that are increasingly hard to find, not just in rural California, but across the state. And if nothing changes, that means longer wait times for patients, traveling further to see a doctor, or skipping care altogether. From Bieber, California, I'm Elizabeth Aguilera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. The Fryant-Kern Canal, which delivers water to farmers and communities on the east side of the valley, is literally sinking in some areas due to groundwater pumping. And with 1 week to go before the California legislature wraps up its 2019 session, many hope the state will help fund the canal's repair. News director Alice Daniel recently sat down with Johnny Amaral, the chief of external affairs for the Fryant Water Authority, to find out more.
Let's start by explaining what the Fryant-Kern Canal is.
So the Fryant-Kern Canal is a 152-mile canal that runs from Fryant Dam down the east side of the San Joaquin Valley, from the dam down to Bakersfield. And the purpose of the canal is to deliver water for irrigation and drinking water purposes to communities on the east side. And it's been in operation for more than 50 years. It's a critical facility for the state of California because there are 1 million acres of farmland and 18,000 farm families and communities that depend on water from the canal.
And now you're investigating the outer banks of a 30-mile stretch of the canal in southern Tulare County from Porterville to Delano to see if the land will support construction of a parallel canal. How come?
Well, due to groundwater overdraft over the course of the last several decades, but most specifically during the time of the last prolonged drought earlier this decade, what we found was that in that area that you articulated from around Porterville to Delano, the canal has begun to subside at a quicker pace than the rest of the canal. So it's created in essence, a bottleneck and a restriction in the ability to move water through that reach of the canal. And so we're looking at ways to fix the canal, which include, as you mentioned, the potential for for building a parallel canal, in essence, a new canal adjacent to the existing canal, and raising the canal liners in certain areas to be able to take water, more volume of water. And of course, we're looking to all levels of government, the state and federal government, and of course, the locals, to help cost share the construction or the fix on the canal.
What is the estimated cost to fix the canal?
The estimated cost today is around $357 million, and that's specific for that region we just talked about, from Porterville to Delano. There are other areas that could be fixed or would warrant some type of attention, but certainly that area is the most urgent need and the area that needs the most attention immediately, because it's creating a situation where we're only able to deliver about 40% of capacity through that canal on that area.
Can you give a specific example of how it's affecting farmers?
Well, if you think about when the demand for water, for irrigation water, comes, it's at its height during the summer months, during the growing season. And if you're a farmer and you're farming south of the pinch point, and you're told that because of this restriction, we just physically can't move the water through the canal to get it to you in a timely manner, it obviously affects your growing season. It prolongs decision making, and it just creates a nightmare situation, because there simply just isn't the volume of water that's able to move through the canal because of the restriction.
And State Senator Melissa Hurtado has authored a $400 million bill that passed in the Senate that may pay for part of this. It sounds like you've got a lot of bipartisan buy-in from politicians.
Yes, I mean, this is it's a very unique project in that regard, because very rarely are any issues, for that matter, bipartisan. But in this case, it's bipartisan and it's bicameral, and it also enjoys support from members of Congress in Washington, Republican and Democrats, and Senator Feinstein. You know, the legislative process is not a science; it's an art, so to speak, and there are other issues at play. There are other priorities. There are other members at play. And so this, as they call it, the sausage making known as legislating, it's not a linear process, right? So we have a lot of work to do in a relatively short amount of time to see if we're going to get any type of commitment from the state of California to help keep this project on track.
And the Sierra Club is against the bill. It says there's nothing in the bill to ensure future subsidence doesn't occur or ensure that conservation measures are imposed. It also says that the major beneficiaries that caused the subsidence in the first place should have to foot the bill. What's your response to that?
Well, I would say that at no time did Friant or the farmers at Friant ever say that we weren't going to be a part of the funding of this project. So that's just not a true statement. Of course, we're going to be a cost share. We're going to have a cost share agreement or cost share partnership in this project, number one. Number two, SGMA, which is a groundwater law that passed in 2014 and has been being rolled out for the last few years and is now about to be the plans, SGMA groundwater sustainability plans, are about to be made public and implemented in January. That is the most likely scenario will take care of future subsidence. I mean, there's still residual subsidence that's going to take place, but future subsidence, SGMA will take care of that. It comes down to, really, at the end of the day, a discussion about is what's done here in the Central Valley, is the crops that we grow and the people who live here and live in the communities and get water off the canal for drinking water or for irrigation, is it important to the state of California and the federal government, for that matter? Does, in essence, what we do here, does it matter? You know, failure is not an option, and we have to keep pushing, because this facility is so important to this valley.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
That was Johnny Amaral, the Chief of External Affairs for the Friant Water Authority. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. The city of Selma, just south of Fresno, wants to change the way citizens vote for council members by creating districts for their city council instead of at-large voting. Reporter Monica Velez has been looking into why the city and community groups have different ideas about how to make that happen. So, Monica, why is the city of Selma doing this right now?
So some other cities in the valley, like Visalia, Tulare, and Lemoore, have been sent what is called a demand letter, which basically says the city must change its voting process or be sued because of the Voting Rights Act. And by the way, the Voting Rights Act is a law that tries to reinforce equal representation. And that's why Selma decided to be proactive about it, because officials figure it's just a matter of time before they get a letter. And just getting this letter, it can cost a city up to $30,000. Mm-hmm. This week, city officials just had their third public hearing, and the Voting Rights Act requires them to have five to inform their community and get feedback from them. Mm-hmm. So at the meeting, the company they hired to make the maps, the NDC, that stands for the National Demographics Corporation, presented three maps the council could choose from later this month.
All right. So what did these maps look like?
So what's interesting is all five of the current council members are concentrated in two neighborhoods on the east side of town. So council members Jim Avalos and John Trujillo live within a few blocks of each other. And Mayor Scott Robertson and Mayor Pro Tem Luis Franco live across the street from each other. And council member Sarah Guerra lives just nearby.
Okay. So are some of the council members, based on the maps the NDC drew, would they have ended up in the same districts?
Actually, no. The three maps the NDC drew have each council member in a separate district, even though they all live in just two areas of the city. Mm. And here's where it gets controversial. So a couple of community members spoke during the public comment and said having the districts like this isn't an accurate representation of the city. So Councilmember Trujillo told me in an interview he agrees with the community. Mm-hmm. So he says some council members are more interested in keeping their seats rather than focusing on what the community wants, but he didn't want to name names. Both Trujillo and Avalos said they wouldn't oppose a map that included more than one current council member in the same district. But Mayor Robertson had another opinion. Here's what he said at the meeting.
Equating looking after the community and districting with kicking a couple of council people out who've gotten votes in the past and who've won is not the same. And that is unjust, and that is gerrymandering, in my opinion.
But the NDC representative at the meeting said that's not gerrymandering, and pairing council members in the same district does not violate the Voting Rights Act in any way.
And so what does the NDC have to say about their own maps?
Well, the NDC says the maps they made are legal, you know, meaning they also don't violate the Voting Rights Act. The founder and president of the NDC, his name's Douglas Johnson, said it's a common practice to consider where the council lives when drawing these maps.
The idea is that it lets the voters decide which council members have earned another term, as opposed to if council members get paired, then it doesn't matter what the voters think. At least one of them can't run again or can't serve another term.
But a Bakersfield-based demographer with 35 years of experience I talked to, Jesus Garcia, said taking into consideration where the current council members live should not be the top priority. And in his opinion, the intent with the NDC maps is to make sure the incumbents keep their seats.
In the ideal world, the idea of incumbency should not come into account. All the other factors that we described should. You know, communities of interest, compactness, continuality, things of that sort. But it's about power, and it's about influence. It's about ego.
So what about community members? I mean, what kind of say do they get in the process?
Yeah, so anyone in the city can submit a map of their own, and eight people actually did do that. The interesting part is all eight maps looked very similar to each other, and all of their maps pair at least two council members in the same district. So Garcia says the community maps provide, you know, some type of insight into how people view their city and which neighborhoods they think are similar to each other. And these particular community maps show that the areas that the council members live in now aren't representative of the whole city.
So then why doesn't the NDC take those maps that community members offered up into consideration?
Well, the NDC says that they did, but because the population is so spread out throughout the city, it wasn't possible for them to create a map similar to the community's maps when you're looking at the population data, which is a very important factor to consider.
To make sure that, you know, each district has about the same amount of people.
Exactly.
All right, so then where does the city go from here?
So the next meeting is on September 16th, and that's when the council and the public will have another chance to discuss these maps. And the council could adopt a map that day, or they could extend the vote. We'll just have to wait and see.
Okay, and when that happens, we'll look to you for more reporting. Thank you so much, Monica.
Thanks, Laura. Caring for a child with acute mental illness can be an overwhelming and isolating experience. And when youth become a threat to themselves or others, resources to keep them safe can be difficult to find. Kathleen Schock spoke with Katie Rice. She's the former Fresno County Behavioral Health Board Vice Chair of the Children's Committee and the mother of a child struggling with mental health needs, developmental disabilities, and medical needs. Also joining the conversation is Chris Roop, Executive Director of the Fresno Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
So, Chris, I'd like to start with you. Tell us a little bit about the circumstances in which a young person would need residential treatment for mental health issues.
Circumstances where a youth may need to leave their own personal home with their family would be when they need a higher level of care for their mental health and behavioral health challenges. They're no longer really able to step into a place of working in recovery and stay well and safe and in their own home environment. And they are going to need additional support that's available for them 24 hours a day. And that's somebody who can keep an eye on them, administer their treatment as it's needed medication, but also coordinating providers that may be coming in to provide individual appointments with them, sessions, or group therapy sessions as well, but really focusing on recovery.
How easy is it for young people who are in these circumstances to get that help at that critical time?
It depends on the level of need and the availability of a placement for them, and the placement being appropriate for the need that they have. In the easiest way to say that, it's very complicated, and it's not as easy as one would think. We don't have enough resources available for, I think, the real big picture need out there. So we tend to keep our youth for a shorter period of time, but in an effort to see improvement, but we do want to get them back into their home environment or into a safer placement that's healthier for them, that may not need that higher level of care, lowering those levels each time they're transitioned.
Katie, from your perspective, how much need is there, particularly in the Central Valley, for residential treatment facilities?
It's a tremendous need. Actually, you know, not just within the state of California, it's a worldwide challenge. And this becomes even more challenging when you have youth with mental health needs that also have maybe a developmental disability as well as medical needs. It then becomes even more challenging to seek placement. I really feel hopeless at times, and I know it's not, but we definitely need residential care, and we need just some of the things that they can provide. It really takes a team approach, collaboration, intensive needs as a whole. Residential facilities can provide an abundance of things for families and the youth they're treating, one-to-one care, 24-hour nursing staff, schools on site, even at some of these facilities, individual counseling throughout the day, outings for the youth, transportation to appointments. And they also provide a home-like environment for the youth because it is longer term, anywhere from a year and up.
And you mentioned that you have sought facilities outside of the state. What would that mean for your family in the event that you were able to get your child placed outside of this geographic area?
It would mean giving up all of the current services that my son has here that may not be available in another state. So California is the only state that provides or that has regional centers. So if you have an individual with a developmental disability that qualifies for regional center, that's not available outside of the state of California. So I would be giving up personal attendant and respite hours that my son currently has to have a provider come into the home and give me a break.
And would your family have to relocate?
Absolutely. Relocate, giving up, and for other families, giving up a job. Maybe they have other children in the home. Where are they going to go? Is there two parents involved and one parent doesn't want the child to go? So there are a lot of obstacles, but it would mean giving up everything you currently have and relocating. But if it's necessary and it's going to help, then you have to do it.
Chris, why is there such a shortage?
Funding, just I think funding, an adequate workforce. Unfortunately, we went through a period of time where our funding was cut back. We had some changes to the mental health system of care as well many years ago. The intention was to have our loved ones cared for within our community in a least restrictive setting. Unfortunately, sometimes our loved ones need a higher level of care. But when we had the intentions, and I say we as a country, had the intention of developing the resources within our communities, that part didn't happen completely. We had some, and then when we had the recession and cut back funding, we didn't have the ability to continue building those resources. So a lot of it is traced back to funding, inadequate workforce, and that's not to say we don't have providers that want to be providers. We don't have providers that have resources to refer their patients and clients to, so it makes it challenging to be a provider in this field.
And just to provide some sense of context, how many beds are available in Fresno County for residential care if you are under the age of 18?
If you are under the age of 18, and between the ages of 12 and 17, and you need acute level care, there are 16 beds available within our county, a facility that has 16 beds. That doesn't necessarily mean that all those placements will be a Fresno County youth. It's the youth that need that, far fewer at one time. However, that's all that's available within our county, and that's shared across our state. So there just aren't enough beds available, and that's for crisis level. So someone who needs to have their rights of freedom removed because they are meeting the criteria that says they're either a danger to themselves or the community, or their wellness is so compromised due to their mental illness, they're not able to have their basic needs met. And that's when we take someone into that placement of care. If you are under the age of 12 in Fresno County, there is not a placement option available, not even one bed. So our children under the age of 12 will need to be sent out of county somewhere else in the state. And if you, as a parent, think about that, your child that you care for every day is now going to be out of county, and you have other obligations, or you don't have the ability to pick up and go, it's a little frightening, and it can really take its toll on the family's wellness.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking about treating teens with mental illness facing acute situations. Katie, tell us about some of the experiences that you've had with your child, and particularly as it pertains to having to go to an emergency room during a moment of crisis.
I've had to take my son to the emergency room many, many times. And each time, in the beginning, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't understand the system and how everything works. And each time that I've gone back, I learned more and more. But essentially, taking my son in through the emergency room, sometimes I can wait a day or more before I have a clinician that comes to do an assessment to determine if he meets criteria for a 5150 hold. And once that decision is made, then the next step is to locate facilities and begin sending packets to find out if there's a facility that A, has a bed available, B, can meet your child's needs, and all in this very short time frame. The biggest obstacle was finding an acute care facility for my son to meet his needs. In the beginning, prior to some of his diagnoses, there were two or three hospitalizations that were made. After other diagnoses were made and I brought him through the ER, they were no longer a viable option. we can't provide services for him because he has epilepsy and we're not an emergency facility, meaning the facility he'd be transferred to.
So then what happens? Does he stay in the ER? Does he get discharged? What happens?
He has stayed many, many days in the emergency room with a one-to-one sitter to watch for his safety, and me spinning my wheels trying and working with a clinician to find out what can we do, what services. Ultimately, it's what can we help you, what can we help provide in the home for you? What would make it easier for you to care for your son? And it's like a clone of me, you know, another person to help me out. And respite is offered in some capacity. But if you don't have an individual that can provide the respite to meet your child's needs, then what do you do?
I wanted to add, in Fresno County, we're very, very fortunate to have a crisis stabilization center that does provide care, immediate care for our youth under the age of 18. And when I say under the age of 18, I think the youngest that they've seen for crisis level, where we're making that initial assessment whether to maintain that hold, that 51-50 hold, the youngest, I believe, is around the age of 5. But that determination needs to be made within 72 hours. And I didn't mention this one a few minutes ago when we were talking about placements, because we hear bed and we think acute level care. Mm-hmm. This is crisis level. Does my child need to stay in a facility for additional support and care? But that is for a child who is only facing psychiatric crisis. With Katie, unfortunately, her son has multiple needs, so he wouldn't be able to go to the crisis stabilization center to be assessed. Because of the complexity of his needs, he's got to go to an emergency room where there's not always providers available to continue assessing.
Katie, as a parent, how do you take care of yourself in these situations? I can imagine it at times must feel hopeless. How do you get through it?
I take each day at a time, and living in the moment and addressing what I can address at the time and not worrying so much, so far ahead. What's going to happen? I always get asked, what's going to happen when he's older? What's going to happen when he becomes a teenager and he's bigger than you? I know that. And I realize that, but I can't think about that. I have to focus my area of concern on what is currently going on, keeping him safe, keeping myself safe, continuing to take him to his doctor's appointments, reaching out to friends. I have an abundance, a large support group of families that are going through very similar situations, and talking with them and sharing some things that you and I could talk about that you would say, that's totally wow, like, but I could talk to another person that's experienced it, and it's like, that's the normal. So they understand, they get it. They've having a support group that validates your feelings, that doesn't pass judgment, that calls, as you have, Chris, just to check in. Are you okay? Is there anything I can help you with? For me, I do a lot of self-care, even if that means I blow dry my hair. Now, it sounds silly, but I take my time blow drying my hair, and I say, you know, I'm not just going to let it air dry today. I'm going to take 5 minutes to blow dry my hair in peace and quiet. I've even locked myself in my bedroom closet and just sat there and just cried, and I felt better afterwards. But I think really the key for me is talking to other families and knowing that I'm not alone, because you're not alone on this journey. There are many people out there suffering.
And speaking of that community, mm-hmm. Chris, tell us about the resources that are available, the work that NAMI does, and how you are building community here with Parents in the Valley.
We are. NAMI is a grassroots organization that was created because family members have loved ones living with mental health challenges, and they found some common things. There are barriers to accessing the resources that do exist. There are limited resources available. And the bigger barrier was stigma. It's not always safe to open up and share about being on this journey, and your feelings, your emotional roller coaster you may be on, and your lack of knowledge of how to care for your loved one, you do at times begin to feel inadequate. But we have to remember, we are, as parents, are supposed to provide our families with love and a safe home and their basic needs, encourage them to be good members of the community as they age and turn into adults. People who are providers for our children with challenges are credentialed. They spend many, many hours earning those letters after their name so that they can provide that higher level of care that our loved ones are going to need. And we don't have that. But NAMI does have education from a peer perspective. And we provide education classes. And if I could encourage families to do anything, learn as much as you possibly can. Katie said it, find your peer support so that you have safe space to open up. That NAMI is providing support groups with families living this journey as well. And then be an advocate. NAMI will help you learn how to tell your story so that you can support others, but also so that you can start to affect change and increase the resources that are available, how to get the resources you need. And Katie's been an example of that. She's learned. She has a safe space to open up somewhere. And now she advocates not only for her son, but she's advocating for others in our community who are on this journey and don't really know what next steps are. And she can share that journey with them.
We just have a couple minutes before we wrap up. Katie, I'd like to give you the last word. What message do you have for somebody who's listening to this conversation who may be in a similar situation?
For me, it was coming to acceptance that my son has very unique and at times challenging needs. So for family members, caregivers, parents, anybody caring for a loved one, is come to acceptance. And this doesn't mean that you're giving up hope. It just means that you stop worrying about the stigma and the judgment surrounding what's going on inside your family. That just brought me a sense of relief when I decided to accept my life and what's going on. Also realize that caregiver burnout is real and that you have to take care of yourself before you can take care of your child or continue taking care of the youth you're caring for. Speak up, talk with your close friends, family, or youth providers and let them know how you're feeling. Know that other people are in the same shoes as you. Realize that you may have many different feelings going on, and that's okay. This is key. It's okay to feel guilt, angry, resentful, sad, overwhelmed, fearful, at your wit's end. These are all normal feelings, and it's okay to feel those things. I know I have felt and continue to feel emotions at different stages of my journey, and never give up hope. Also, surround yourself with positive people and read and educate yourself on your youth's needs. You're their best advocate. You know them best, so you know what they need. And for those getting services and other, you know, with other agencies, is just because it hasn't been created and doesn't exist doesn't mean that they can't develop it. Get creative.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. The writer Gerald Haslam grew up at the southern end of the San Joaquin Valley and is credited with coining the phrase the other California to describe the part of the state where we live. Not Los Angeles, not San Francisco, not the coastal California, but the other California, a unique, highly diverse region with its own stories to tell. Over the next few months, we'll be developing a podcast called The Other California that looks at the people, places, and themes that make this region stand out as different from the rest of the state. To get the project underway, news director Alice Daniel sat down with peach farmer and writer Mas Masumoto and his daughter, peach farmer, and artist Nikiko Masumoto to find out what The Other California means to them.
Mas, when Nikiko was going to college, you wrote her a letter, and I believe you entitled it, I don't know if you entitled it The Other California.
I did.
You did? Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about why you chose to focus on that.
I think part of it had to do with my memory of when I left for college. I ended up going to Berkeley, leaving the Valley, and realizing how different it was and how different we were. At that time, I thought it was because I was wrong. I you know, the Valley wasn't the right place. But I wanted to write this letter to Nikiko to both warn her of what to expect, but also to understand that, no, where we may be different, but we're not inferior. We're not necessarily misfits that don't belong. We belong in our own way, and that's why we are part of the other California.
Would you like to read a little bit of the beginning of it?
Absolutely. And I made it like a letter because I was writing my newspaper columns as letters at that time. But it was the idea of something being very personal, too, which is, I think, the hallmark of the Valley. Things are very personal here. We take things personally. The other California. Dear Nikiko, soon, my daughter, you'll be off to college. And when people ask, where are you from, how will you respond? Will you answer, I'm from Del Rey, a phrase no one uses because Del Rey is not on most maps? Or will you simply respond, Fresno, generating responses about our dense winter fog and people in blistering summer heat? I suggest you say, I'm from the other California.
And you suggest she say that because?
Because it's so easy to sort of lower your voice and say, I'm just from Fresno in an embarrassing way. Or you just say, I don't want to talk about where I'm from, as opposed to saying, no, we're part of California, but it's the other California, not the inferior California, not the the California that people despise, but really something different and has its own identity and uniqueness.
And that's because in part of the response we get when we tell people who are from San Francisco or Los Angeles, we live in Fresno or Del Rey, we often get kind of a snub.
Oh, a sneer, a snicker, this notion of they're superior and we're inferior. And part of the idea is, no, we're just as valid and have a voice. In fact, we have as important, if not a better voice than you on certain matters.
And Nikiko, what was your response when you got this letter from your father?
I think when he first wrote it, I wasn't quite sure how to take it because I was so excited to leave. I was so excited to make my own path. And then once I did get to Berkeley, and certainly thereafter, I have come to understand what I think my dad is calling for in that letter is a deep pride and strength in understanding what is indigenous to the Valley. And that when people respond, oh, I think I've driven through there, that's they're missing out, and that there's good work here, good people here. And a really significant story of California is the story of the San Joaquin Valley.
Right. And you often hear of the flyover states, and this is the drive-through part of California.
Yep.
But people are missing so much. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, now that you're older and you've come back and you're working on the farm, Do you think about that letter differently?
That's a great question. I think about that letter differently in terms of the moment we are in now feels like a really important moment about shaping the future of California. And I wonder, now that I'm older and now that I'm married and starting to think about starting my own family, what is the letter I'm going to write to my future child about this place, about this valley?
And will it still be the other California?
Right. Or will it be the magnificent other California? Or will it be the innovative other California? I don't know.
Or the new California.
Yes. There's so much to happen. And I think there's so much uncertainty about the valley and its future, especially as climate changes, especially as water politics seem to just get more ferocious and less generous in solutions. So I think we have a lot to write in the story of our valley.
Also, there's this other aspect of the other California. I think a lot of people from the Valley, we have this inferiority complex. And part of writing that letter for me was the notion that we need to begin to trust ourselves and trust our own stories.
Well, one thing I noticed you said earlier, you said people in the Valley take things personally. What did you mean by that?
It could be perceived as both as positive and a negative. I think because we know people, our neighbors a lot, we have history here, we have generations here, we have legacy here, we take things in a very personal way. At the same time, we could take it so personal that we are offended when people criticize us. We sometimes become intolerant of other ideas and thoughts and innovations. So that's the struggle that we have. We take it personal, and that sometimes we take it too personally.
So it's almost like the Valley is cloistered in a way.
Yeah, and that's a challenge sometimes because change happens slow here. And for some people, a lot of young people, they want rapid change, and that's why they leave. And on the other hand, though, it's change in general is slow. There's this perception that it happens really fast, and that's not true. I mean, if you especially think of the important things in life, which I think are around family, families take a long time to change. And in some cases, they don't change until someone moves on or passes away.
Exactly, until somebody switches gears and makes everybody else respond to whatever they're doing.
Exactly.
Nikiko, I'm curious, when you think of just the phrase, the other California, what comes to mind for you?
Automatically people of color, because in my kind of intellectual development, thinking about the word the other is so loaded. And we have for a long time been a valley of a majority people of color living, working, loving, struggling here. And so there's a way in which the use of that term brings to light so many of the uncomfortable discussions that need to be had and are happening, but need to continue to happen, not only conversation, but action, in order that the other California is no longer the story of the marginalized, but it might be a story of the people who call our attention to the ways in which we are so limiting ourselves in our structures of our lives when we don't take into consideration the people who have long suffered at the hands of structures that were not designed for them.
And give me some examples of the kinds of conversations we might have on the other California.
I could imagine conversations with people who live in unincorporated towns specifically. Talk about places that are literally not on maps and people don't even know exist. I could imagine conversations about really deep social justice work that's happening here, but might not have the glitz and glam of the Bay Area or Southern California. I can also imagine conversations about place and the types of objects that link us to this place that are so different than other parts of California. Old tools, tombstones, things that really mark life, love, work. I think that
the history.
Yes, the history of this valley.
And Moss, when you think about themes or motifs that make up the other California, what comes to mind?
Oh, I think those things that seem to be invisible and are often silent. And they're often invisible and silent because we are humble. And a lot of things that happen in the Valley work with much humility. And I would love to see that kind of humility be brought up and those stories be heard and understood. And a simple example is when you think of the dynamic of generations. And urban worlds tend to work with one generation, where in the Valley you have multiple generations living together, working together, or at least that sense of history is here. That's, I think, an important part because that sense of history defines who we are. A lot of people who live in cities or the coastal California kind of think they created their world, and they are wrong, all right? Because they don't realize, one, families always dictate who and what we turn out to be, but also the history of the state was really founded on these generations of things that happened that created a legacy that we live with today. So you could think of anything in the political world and policy world. No, they were founded on things that were part of my memory growing up or even more. A real simple one is if you look at water. in this state. There's so many layers of water and policy of water that surrounded, that was formed with riparian water rights that were formed in the early 1900s, or when the Central Valley Water Project came in the 1960s. Those are all impacting us today in how we use water. So water has this deep sense of history with it, let alone the natural history of the valley too.
And if we don't understand that history, we can't make proper decisions.
Exactly. And we tend to ignore and devalue what we have, such as water.
So let me ask you one more question. How do we tell the story of the other California?
I think the first thing of telling the story of the other California is deepening our deep listening muscles and what it means to actually bear witness to how people are living here in the valley. The second part, I think, is asking ourselves, what is our role in not only our action of listening, but what is our role in supporting and living in partnership so that people can tell their own stories, whether that's sharing skills, capacity building, or even just the spark of the idea that everyone's story is worthy of being told.
And everyone's story is interesting.
Absolutely. But so many of us carry wounds that make us believe that our stories don't count. And there's so many aspects of life that do transform the complexities and wholeness of our lives into a number. And that's exactly what we need to rail against. You know, whenever I hear statistics about poverty in the valley, for example, those are important, and it is important to track and look at the large picture. But when you sit with someone and they tell you about how they lost their job because they hurt their back, those are the moments where something galvanizing is unfolded in someone's story that you can't look away from.
And just because life is hard for somebody does not make them invisible. And I think that's sort of the way our society is shaped sometimes.
And it doesn't mean they're lacking joy either.
Precisely.
We are all complex whole beings, and it's so easy to gloss over that.
Mm-hmm. It's so easy to write people off.
I think it's important to look at the voices of the other California and understand that sense of value that they carry. Especially in this modern era, we tend to equate value with making a lot of money. And that is anything but the truth, because there's so many things that are important here in the valley that have immense value precisely because it's not about money. And those are the things I think people really find that sense of joy in, and it's the definition of family in many ways. I think the other thing I would listen for are the sounds of the other California, and we'll do a demonstration of the sound of the other, of our part of the state too. But I think that's important too, because incorporated in listening to the sounds as opposed to just the voices is to be able to hear the silence that's part of the valley here too.
Well, let's go ahead and do that. Let's demonstrate this sound that you're talking about.
Okay. We'd like to show or have you understand the sounds of the other California. And it goes like this from our family farm. That's the sound of eating a ripe peach.
Thank you so much. It was fabulous having you, Moss, and you, Nakiko, on.
Thank you, Alice.
Thanks.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
We'd also like to hear from you. What does the other California mean to you? Tell us your story or the story of someone else you know by calling 559-862-2714 or emailing talk@kvpr.org.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team. Alice Daniel, Monica Velez,
Carrie Klein, and Laura Sitsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Monica Velez.
And I'm Laura Sitsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.